Welcome to the Legal Aid New South Wales Criminal Law Division podcast. The Criminal Law Division of Legal Aid New South Wales acknowledges the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as the traditional custodians of the land and waters. We acknowledge this podcast is recorded on Aboriginal land and pay our respect to elders past and present. We extend that respect to First Nations listeners joining us here today.
Welcome to episode 4 of the Five Cases podcast. I'm Caitlin Akhtar of Forbes Chambers, and I'm speaking to you from Gadigal land.
And I'm Paul Crady. I'm a public defender at the New South Wales Public Defender's Office. In today's edition, recorded on the 5th of October 2023, we're looking at cases dealing with the following topics. Caitlin, what are you going to look at?
I'm looking at two recent cases in which the Court of Criminal Appeal considered sentences imposed on children. And I'll also be reviewing a decision of the Supreme Court about a magistrate's approach to a defendant's self-defence case.
Thanks, Caitlin. I'm going to be looking at two cases on tendency and how they might be relevant to defence practitioners. Caitlin.
Great. Well, let's start with ZXT, a pseudonym, and R, 2023, New South Wales CCA 222. So ZXT is a pseudonym for a person sentenced for a reckless wounding in company that he committed when he was 17 years old. He had offered to plead guilty to this offence in the Children's Court, which could have been dealt with by that court. The Crown didn't accept the offer, and the matter proceeded to the District Court trial on a more serious charge, with the reckless wounding charge as an alternative count. He was acquitted of that more serious charge. So after applying a 25% discount for his early offer to plead guilty, the judge imposed a control order, which is juvenile detention, of 18 months with a non-parole period of 9 months. ZXT had sought a suspended control order, and these are still available to children, even though they're no longer available to adults. The sentencing judge did not refer to this option in the remarks on sentence. The Court of Criminal Appeal, in this case Justice of Appeal Adamson with Justices Wright and Fagan agreeing, held that the sentencing judge was required to consider the option of a suspended control order. The fact that no remarks were made about the option indicated that it wasn't considered, and this was an error. However, the court dismissed the appeal, even though it was the appellant's first charge and the offending was very much out of character. The seriousness of the offence and the age of the appellant led the court to the conclusion that no lesser sentence was warranted. By comparison, the case of TM and R, 2023, New South Wales CCA 185, is another decision delivered around the same time. TM, again a pseudonym for a juvenile, was sentenced for an offence of aggravated robbery causing grievous bodily harm, committed when he was 15 years old. This is a serious children's indictable offence, so he wasn't eligible to be dealt with in the children's court. He needed to be dealt with at law. And all that means is not sentenced to a penalty available under the Children's Criminal Proceedings Act. So he was sentenced to a term of imprisonment of 3 years with a non-parole period of 12 months. The Court of Criminal Appeal, in this case Justice Yehia, with Justices of Appeal Payne and Stern agreeing, allowed the appeal and re-sentenced the applicant to a non-parole period of 9 months with an additional term of 2 years and 3 months. In this case, the court was persuaded that in addition to the principles for sentencing children that are in Section 6 of the Children Criminal Proceedings Act, the sentencing judge was also required to assess the impact of the offender's young age on his moral culpability. The court held that the impact of age and of deprivation on moral culpability were separate. The court held an offender's moral culpability may be reduced, even significantly reduced, by virtue of a background of deprivation and disadvantage. That is a separate consideration from an offender's youth. A young offender's moral culpability may be reduced as a result of a combination of factors, which in the relevant case may include a background of dysfunction and youth, two separate considerations. The court also held, in assessing the moral blameworthiness of the applicant, the sentencing judge was required to take into account the particular features relating to his young age. Those features were directly relevant to the applicant's moral culpability, because they did not involve any of the indicia of mature decision-making.
Thanks, Caitlin. TM particularly is a very clear case, and I've certainly used it in my submissions. The first case I want to focus on looks at how defence practitioners might deal with tendency evidence and how we might start thinking about adducing tendency evidence by the defence and what directions should be given by the trial judge in response. And the second case is about an anti-tendency direction and where it might be used. First of all, tendency evidence adduced by the defence. It's probably fair to say that the focus of most, if not all, of the important tendency cases have focused on the Crown's use of tendency and context evidence to prove a case against an accused person. Cases such as the Queen and Bower, IMM and the Queen, and Hughes and the Queen all dealt with the admission of tendency or context evidence in the Crown case to show a tendency to act in a certain way or to have a certain state of mind. In contrast, far fewer cases have looked at the use of the tendency provisions by accused persons. That is probably the product of some structural reasons within the Evidence Act, but it may also show a failure or reluctance by us defence practitioners to use the full force of the tendency provisions in our favour. And Waldron and the King is a good example of how an accused person can harness the power of tendency evidence in meeting a criminal charge. Waldron is spelt W-A-L-D-R-O-N and the King, square brackets 2023, New South Wales CCA 128. So it's a good example of how an accused person can harness tendency evidence, but it also sets out some clear principles of the standard of proof applicable to such evidence and what directions should be sought by defence practitioners and given by trial judges. Here, it was a pretty simple factual scenario. The accused was charged with wounding her domestic partner following a violent interaction. The accused raised self-defence and sought to adduce evidence of the complainant's tendency to act in a violent way in the past. And the way they did this was important. They sought to prove the tendency by way of tendering a number of documents, including agreed facts, presumably tendered at the complainant's sentence hearing. I want to highlight this part of the judgment. There was actually no further discussion about what documents were used to prove the tendency. And often this is difficult for defence practitioners. We might have an odd assortment of documents, such as a court attendance notice, or some amended police facts, and a criminal record showing an eventual conviction. We might be missing signed agreed facts if the matter proceeded in the local court. We might not have access to a sentence judgment, which sets out what facts were found against that particular person. So while in this case it's clear that the evidence was sufficient to support the tendency and was admitted, this is an area that I expect will cause issues for defence practitioners in the future. What documents can evidence a tendency? Regardless, in this case, the evidence was held to be sufficient by the trial judge and ultimately admitted, and was admitted by way of agreed facts. However, the difficulty arose with the directions and how that evidence was to be dealt with by the jury. The trial judge gave directions to the jury that the jury should not draw an inference that the complainant had a tendency to act in a particular way unless it was the only rational inference, and that the jury could take the tendency evidence into account only if it was more likely than not that the tendency evidence was proved. And effectively what occurred in this case was that the direction on tendency was combined with both the standard circumstantial evidence direction and also a standard of proof was imposed. That is, the evidence had to be more likely than not. The CCA disagreed and set out some very helpful guidelines for tendency evidence adduced by an accused person. And in summary, it's this. First, there's no requirement that tendency evidence be proved to any particular standard. There's no onus of proof on an accused person. Therefore, the jury should not have been warned to exercise caution before drawing inferences based on the tendency evidence. They should not have been directed that all other rational inferences needed to be excluded. And the reasoning of the CCA was straightforward. It was not appropriate to warn the jury about being very careful about drawing an inference favourable to an accused. This introduced a standard of, sorry, there was also the introduction of a standard of proof being more likely than not, and this was an incorrect as it imposed an onus of proof on the accused. And lastly, it was not appropriate to use the circumstantial evidence direction, which usually focuses on drawing inferences adverse to the accused in relation to tendency evidence. So it's a relatively simple case, but it's on an area of law that I expect to see a lot more being published by the CCA, and that is the use of tendency evidence by defence practitioners. And in that, I'd encourage practitioners to consider the use of tendency notices on not just complainants, but also other witnesses being called in the Crown case, such as police officers or medical experts. The second case I want to look at also looks at tendency, but what is the so-called anti-tendency direction. And this is the case of NGO and the King, 2023, New South Wales Court of Criminal Appeal 201. And I'm simply using NGO as a reminder or a counterpoint to the previous case of what an anti-tendency direction is and when it might be appropriate. I'm sure defence practitioners have all had the circumstance where a complainant in evidence in chief alleges further wrongdoing against an accused person than what is included in statements to police or recorded interviews, and those answers to questions are non-responsive and very hurtful to accused persons. Well, that's where an anti-tendency direction is sometimes relevant. It's a warning to the jury that, particularly where there have been non-responsive answers to questions, the jury cannot reason in a tendency fashion. Now, the facts of NGO are not that important, but from paragraph 99, the court discusses the history of anti-tendency provisions, noting that they are not required in all cases and highlighting a very important fact. They may indeed highlight non-responsive and hurtful evidence in a prejudicial way to the accused. In that manner, the CCA is highlighting the care that needs to be taken in considering whether to apply for an anti-tendency direction. In this case, there was an interesting difference of opinions between judges of the CCA as to whether an anti-tendency direction should have been given. What's important is not so much the result, but the fact that defence practitioners realise that in the case of complainants who offer unresponsive and hurtful evidence, that we should consider the use of an anti-tendency direction. Caitlin, that's enough tendency from me. What do you have?
Well, I'm going to finish on a totally different topic. In the case of Darlington and the Director of Public Prosecutions, New South Wales, 2023, New South Wales SC 1139. Darlington is a decision of the Supreme Court reviewing a decision of a local court magistrate. I think it's helpful for anybody who practices in a local court, and it's also a nice reminder of the law of self-defence. So in short, Mr. Darlington was charged with a fray and convicted following a two-day hearing. He was sentenced to a conditional release order without conviction. The Supreme Court considered that a person dealt with in that way could pursue a conviction appeal to the Supreme Court, even though no conviction was recorded. At hearing, it was not in issue that Mr. Darlington struck the other man, called Mr. Darling, with a yabby pump. The issue at the local court hearing was whether the prosecution were able to prove beyond reasonable doubt that he did not do so in self-defence. By the time of hearing, Mr. Darling, that was the victim, had been convicted of a fray and common assault as a result of his part in the altercation. In convicting Mr. Darlington, the magistrate reviewed the facts as he found them and concluded, "I am not satisfied that subjectively it was necessary, and objectively it certainly was beyond the pale." The Supreme Court's assessment of this conclusion was that magistrate approached the matter on the basis that it was necessary for the plaintiff, that is the accused person, to satisfy the court that subjectively it was necessary. Additionally, the magistrate did not consider the circumstances as the defendant perceived them. The court concluded that both of these matters reflected error. The court also held that the magistrate had failed to engage with the submissions made by Mr. Darlington's lawyer, and that a failure to engage with or respond to a clearly articulated and substantial submission is an error of law. In concluding his reasons in the Supreme Court judgment, Justice Tangi noted that Mr. Darlington's lawyer's closing submissions took about 4 minutes, and that during them she handed up 7 pages of helpful written submissions. The magistrate began to deliver his judgment about 5 seconds after the defendant's closing submissions had finished, and so could not have properly considered the written submissions in coming to his judgment. Justice Tangi said this showed a regrettable lack of respect for Mr. Darlington's lawyer and for Mr. Darlington, and that it was unfair. As a result of the appeal being upheld, the matter was referred back to the local court for a new hearing, but before a different magistrate.
Thanks, Caitlin. Hopefully that gives some support to our hardworking local court listeners.
Absolutely.
Just a reminder, you can contact the hosts, that is Caitlin, Sophie Anderson and myself, on our email address, 5casespodcast@gmail.com. And we'd love to hear from you if you have any cases or issues that you'd like us to review cases on.
Yes, and thank you also to Jamie Simonson from the Albury Legal Aid Office, who suggested the 2 cases I started with today on sentencing children for today's episode.
Just a reminder, this is a monthly podcast in which we summarise 5 cases relevant to defence practitioners. In the next episode, we're going to have a special edition, and it's going to be a foundational 5 cases podcast where we will be reviewing 5 cases relevant to arrest and investigation powers. Thanks very much for listening, and speak to you soon.